This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL. Up next, Magnus Oman is joined by Dr. Robin Hoffman, consulting cardiologist at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden, and Dr. Richard Chazal, medical director of the Heart and Vascular Institute at Lee Health in Fort Myers, Florida. They cover determination of the role of oxygen in suspected acute myocardial infarction.
So welcome both.
Thank you.
So Rick, I will maybe start with you. All of us recognize that oxygen has been omnipresent in our practice of medicine, particularly when it comes to acute myocardial infarction or sick patients. But this is also the era where we take these omnipresent old therapies and test them. But tell us a little bit about the U.S. guidelines about oxygen therapy in suspected acute myocardial infarction, which is the area we're talking about, and yet how much of it is used.
Well, the 2014 ACC-AHA guidelines on NSTEMI suggested that oxygen should be used if the saturation was less than 90%. Didn't speak much to what one should do if it was over 90%, and that was a 1C recommendation. The underpinnings of that recommendation were based on a little bit of observational studies and some theoretical potential harm. That being said, it's very commonplace for us in clinical medicine to go in the emergency room or the ICU or the cardiac floor and see that most patients actually are on supplemental oxygen. And in fact, it's very common for our nursing staff or emergency staff to put the patient on oxygen immediately.
Because we feel good about it.
And we're trying to do something that traditionally we thought was helpful.
Right. Now, the European guidelines, Robin, are a little bit different. So just for perspective here, what do they say about oxygen therapy?
They have changed actually gradually during the years. And when we started the trial, it was still a very strong recommendation for basically all of the patients. Then it changed to, at least in the STEMI guidelines, to below 95%. And it was a similar a 1C recommendation based on expert opinion. And now I've just heard they've been updated and the border is now 90% with the updated guidelines 2017.
So tell us a little bit about the background here, because there was also some results of some small studies that may have suggested harm with oxygen therapy, which so we have what we traditionally use based on old-fashioned physiological thinking and then some harm, and then you set out to do an important trial. So tell us a little bit about the older data.
Yeah, that was a study from Australia. It's called the AVOID trial on 441 patients randomized to oxygen or air. And they showed increased infarct size in people on oxygen. They used creatinine kinase as a somewhat old-fashioned marker, but it was significant. There was a significant difference. They used closed masks. They used 8 liters. And it was a pre-hospital study. It's important to remember. And only in patients with STEMI.
So describe the study to us, because it's pretty important, therefore, to get this right.
We had a different approach. We believed that it was patients with suspected infarction that was the reasonable group to study, because oxygen is given at presentation. It is given in the field of ambulance staff, of patients in primary care practices in Sweden. And so we needed to get there early. So we had an online randomization on site. And if the patient was randomized to oxygen, we used 6 liters per minute in an open face mask. It was initiated on site when randomized. The control group received ambient air.
And so patients were admitted, and you must keep track of these patients, not like we do in North America. So how do you collect the data for this type of endeavor?
It was a registry-based randomized trial. So in Sweden, we have a national quality registry in coronary care that covers all the hospitals who have coronary care facilities in the whole country. And we cover more than 90% of all the infarctions per year in Sweden. And so what we did is that we used this infrastructure to do the trial and collect secondary endpoints, you might say, and then the primary endpoint, death, is from the population registry, which is virtually complete.
It's amazing. So how long were you following the patients after the suspected MI?
For 1 year.
So 1 year mortality outcomes data, I think everybody's really wanting to know, what did it show?
It was similar in both groups. It was no different. Mortality was 5% in the oxygen group and 5.1% in the ambient air group.
And the majority of these patients, though, had oxygen saturation as they entered the trial above 90%?
Absolutely. That was the inclusion criteria. The median was 97%.
So these were pretty much fairly well oxygenated by standards.
Absolutely. And I think there was a shift, actually, when you look at the patients, because previously the patients were much sicker, because most of our patients actually are not hypoxemic anymore when we see them. We come there early, we treat them early, we get them to cath lab early, and hypoxemia is not a big problem anymore.
So, Rick, does these findings surprise you?
I don't think it's a surprise. I think it's a validation, though, that's very, very important. And I think it's interesting that some observational studies and the study that he mentioned before in Australia had suggested potential harm. In this case, there was no difference. And the other thing, Robin, I think you looked at troponin levels as well to see if there was a difference, not just in mortality, but in infarction and no change. Is that correct?
That's correct. The findings are virtually identical. And it's good to know that it was not small infarctions. The troponin T was about 1,000 in median. So it was sick people.
This is very helpful. This is yet another old-fashioned idea that goes down, which is very helpful. Now, you obviously must have looked at some other secondary endpoints like heart failure, reinfarction, and all of those things. Of course, only in hospital, right? Because you don't collect the data long-term, maybe.
In this publication, we have presented one-year rehospitalization for infarction, which was also neutral, and the composite of the two, same without any effect. And we will have much more data, and we can follow patients for life. And it's not only that we have the population registry, we have also an inpatient registry and an outpatient registry, which is not complete, but almost complete. So we will have rehospitalization for heart failure that will be available later this year. Supposedly, we have, well, about 3,000 patients with STEMI, where we have complete procedure-related outcomes that we will present very soon.
So this is a very complete data set, but yet it's work in progress for us to get there. So what would you say to physicians, Rick, now that we have this information? So we have above 90, we have a fairly clear-cut answer. So what's your recommendation for physicians?
Well, the ability to measure oxygen saturation is so ubiquitous in emergency departments on the floor and in emergency vehicles that I think moving toward the paradigm where we don't routinely give oxygen, but instead check first, makes a lot of sense. We didn't see any harm in this study, but it is a cost factor in the United States where we're starting to move from volume to value, and we have to take all of this into account. It takes extra time, extra equipment, and extra money. There just isn't any reason for us to be utilizing this.
Important study to share this information with us. Now, you tested above 90. What is your gut feeling? Where should we introduce oxygen? And I recognize this may fall slightly out of sight of the study.
It's a difficult question. If you look, you know, on the theoretical basis, there's somewhere around 85. Dissociation curve drops very steeply. And I think 90 is probably a reasonable border than this. We just heard, and this is very true, we have to keep checking. It's not that we now can not monitor oxygen saturation, because obviously when, and I mean, these patients, they can get hypoxemic of many reasons, and then they need oxygen. So we cannot stop looking. But I think the general patient today is not hypoxemic, and then they don't need oxygen.
As a very clear message, monitor and only treat when it's below 90 or 85% maybe. That's very helpful. I want you just to speak for 1 second about the fact that you're able to collect all this data and you then perform important randomized comparisons to try to better our science. This is very remarkable because you've shed some important light here. Do you think this should be done everywhere?
Well, I think it's in principle, it's obviously possible everywhere because we learn a lot of new things now because this is more like a real life population. This is not a small RCT population where you pick out exactly one category of patient you want to study. This is all the patients who show up. And I think the data is different. And the data for Sweden is not the same as it would be in the States or in other countries. So I think it's important, and especially questions that are clinically relevant, and we have no one who gives us money to study it, we can maybe only study this way. And, you know, I'm actually not Swedish, I'm German. In Germany, it wouldn't be possible. In Sweden, there is the attitude different. People see that we have the ability and they join you and we don't pay them. I just tell them it's important, please help us, and they do it.
So Rick, to finalize this discussion, which has been fascinating, the American College of Cardiology has invested a lot in this particular idea of collecting the data. Do you think we should sort of go national?
So the National Cardiovascular Data Registry is the largest repository of that type of data that we have. And moving forward, increasingly, we're recognizing that, as Robin has suggested, in an era where pharmaceutical funding or industry funding for some RCTs is drying up, this is a great opportunity for us to leverage that data to provide the real science we need to drive us forward. So great study, really helpful.
And I want to thank you, Robin, but to thank you also, Rick, that this has been very helpful. You've given us some great science that we need to pay attention to, and you've done it in the most streamlined possible approach to help us all. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.